This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm very, very excited to share this podcast with you today because, many of you know that I've been writing and blogging and podcasting on the subject of the Whole 30 diet. It's a paleo diet, and many of you have followed my journey through the Whole 30 diet, and I've shared with you, a lot of description of the diet, my own personal experiences, some suggestions for recipes, some paleo diet hacks that you can employ to make it feasible to follow this type of diet. And so it's with great pleasure that today I share with you an interview with the co-originator of the Whole 30 diet. She's Melissa Hartwig. Melissa developed the diet in 2009, and it's a phenomenon. It's gone viral. She's written a couple of books. It Starts with Food, and also a book entitled The Whole 30. And it's kind of a grassroots phenomenon that has really swept the diet world. So without further ado, let's introduce Melissa Hartwig. Melissa, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Dr. Hoffman, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. Well, tell us how this got started. It was sort of like a little bit of an improvisation because you, together with Dallas Hartwig, put together your version of paleo. And how did that come about?
We did. So back in 2009, we attended a paleo nutrition seminar put on by Rob Wolf, who's been a friend and mentor to both of us for quite some time. And in his paleo seminar, Rob kind of talked about the tenets of paleo and then towards the end said, you know what, just try it for 30 days. Give it a shot. See what changes. So maybe a month later, Dallas and I were sitting around after a really difficult training session. I was actually eating Thin Mints at the time, a true story, and he kind of looked down at me and said, why don't we do this 30-day all-in super squeaky clean paleo experiment? Let's see what it does to our performance in the gym and our recovery, our strength. And I said, okay, that sounds really good. I'm still eating my Thin Mints. When do you want to start? And he looked at me and he said, how about right now? And I'm always up for a good challenge. So I put the Thin Mints down and I said, you're on. And we did it. And so that was really the start of what was to become the first Whole 30, this 30-day squeaky clean, pull out all of these foods that are very commonly problematic across a broad range of people, and then reintroduce them carefully and systematically and see what changes.
Indeed. Yeah. So one of the issues that comes up whenever we discuss paleo, and I've written about this, is who's paleo? In other words, who's the mm-hmm. arbiter of what is paleo? And then, and we look at the anthropology and we realize that there probably was, the caveman diet, the stereotypical, Fred Flintstone brontosaurus steak. He literally lifts this like a giant steak that looks like, mm-hmm. The size of an umbrella and throws it on the barbecue. That is a stereotypical view of what cavemen ate. And so it's not just about 22-ounce porterhouse steaks, is it?
No, not at all. And that's one of the common misconceptions of both a paleo-style diet and a Whole 30 program is that it's super meat-heavy. In fact, our recommendations are relatively moderate in terms of protein. We want you to eat naturally raised, naturally protein, naturally fed protein, with every meal. But our portion sizes, the lower end of our recommendations, are actually right in line with what the USDA recommends in terms of protein. And you're balancing that animal protein out with a lot of plants, tons and tons of vegetables, a wide variety of vegetables, fruit. So it's certainly not a meat-centric diet.
Indeed. You know, and what I have to say is that my own experience of the diet is that while before the diet, I ate a fair amount of animal protein. I was no means a vegan. In changing to the diet, I haven't added more meat. I've simply added more fresh vegetables and fruits. I've been experimenting with some vegetables, for example, that I haven't eaten for years. I'm eating things like, turnips and rutabaga and kohlrabi and, exotic vegetables that I didn't really pay that much attention to. I'm making butternut squash and winter squash and Hokkaido squash, things that, I can't remember making since perhaps my macrobiotic years. So I'm actually adding more in the way of non-animal foods to my diet to create diet diversity. The first thing I did when I started the diet is I put the toaster away. No more gluten-free bagels, no more, which was rough. I was a little wistful as I put it away in the cabinet. I thought, because that's a real shortcut for breakfast, a couple eggs and, a couple of, gluten-free English muffins and you're good to go. But that's not permissible on this diet. So maybe you can lay out, some of the basic ground rules.
Sure. So it's not permissible during the 30-day kind of experimental portion of the Whole30. We highly discourage people from eating technically compliant, but not really in the spirit of a reset, baked goods, sweets, and treats. Part of the Whole30 is really designed to change your habits and your emotional relationship with food. And you're not going to change your habits if you simply swap out the muffins, waffles, pancakes, and cookies you used to eat with almond flour or coconut flour versions of the same thing. Mm-hmm. So during the elimination period, those are off limits. What you are eating for 30 days are, as you described, meat, seafood, and eggs, lots and lots of vegetables and fruit, natural healthy fats. What we're eliminating for 30 days would be all forms of added sugar, all forms of alcohol, all grains, all legumes, including beans, peas, soy, and peanuts, and we're eliminating almost all dairy for the 30-day period. And again, just as an experiment to take this stuff out and then put it back in at the end of the 30 days to see how your body does both with and without these potentially problematic triggers.
Okay, so let's drill down a little bit and look at each of these food groups. Why the elimination of grains? And in your books, by the way, one of the things I like about your books is the book is a pep talk. It's sort of like do it, and it really is very motivational to read the books, because it's sort of like suck it up, do it for 30 days, see how you feel. But it's also there's a lot of really good scientific information in those books that provides the rationale for why you're making these draconian changes in your diet. So let's take a look at some of these food groups that you consider, quote, problematic. And not necessarily that these food groups are, nobody should ever eat these food groups, but that it's worth exploring eliminating them and the effect on your particular, either your medical condition or your well-being, energy, weight, and so on.
Exactly. And thank you for pointing that out. We're not saying there's nothing good to be had in these foods. We're not even saying they're problematic for you. All I'm saying is until you pull them out and reintroduce them, you won't know how they impact you. So grains, for example, obviously gluten grains have been incredibly well studied because of the celiac population and how easy it is to sort of very specifically target a particular protein found in gluten grains with this population, with this particular autoimmune condition that is so incredibly sensitive. But there are spectrums of sensitivity to grains, either because of the gluten component, because of other potentially problematic proteins, maybe because of the FODMAP or fermentable carbohydrate component. Maybe it's just that we tend to overconsume mm-hmm. these grain-based processed foods because they are rewarding and hyper palatable, yep. and a lot of the fiber and nutrition and water has been sucked out of the refined versions. There are a number of reasons why grains are very commonly problematic in the scientific literature and in my clinical experience. So what we're encouraging people to do is pull them out for 30 days, replace them with fruits and vegetables, reintroduce them carefully and systematically, and see how they impact you.
And they're also a readily available source of starch, and fairly, unless you get them in the truly whole grain form, like wheat berries or, barley berries, mostly they're consumed in a refined or semi-refined form. So they're kind of a quick hit to your insulin response. And there's so many people who have issues with blood sugar that it may make sense to explore an elimination of grains.
Yes, you're exactly right. That's a very good point, too, with respect to hormonal balance and blood sugar regulation.
Right. Now, on that subject, of interest is, some people think, okay, this is a ketogenic diet. This is like no carbs. That's not the case at all. In fact, there are liberal carbs. As far as I'm concerned, I consume a lot of starchy vegetables on this program, even potatoes. Although not refined potatoes, I'm not having like instant mashed potatoes, that is probably the glycemic index is through the roof. It's got to be, whole potatoes. Also a fair amount of fruit, but no juice, no jam, no refined fruits. But, one of the issues is that maybe for some people, that's a bit of a loophole that they need to be, and I think you point this out in the book, that they have to be a little cognizant of how much of those carby, starchy vegetables and fruits that they add.
Yeah, some people do. One sort of built-in buffer is that it's really hard to overconsume real whole food in its natural, yes. unprocessed form, because you've got those built-in satiety factors of fiber, maybe complete protein, you've got water, you've got micronutrition. So eating a bag of potato chips is way easier than it is to eat three entire baked potatoes, especially if there's a little bit of ghee or clarified butter on top. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely not a ketogenic diet. You are certainly eating carbohydrate in the forms of vegetables and fruit if you're very active. You exercise frequently, you do high intensity activity, you have a very active lifestyle, you'll purposefully want to include more of those things in your meals. If you're not particularly active, it's great to throw in a little bit of potato or butternut squash or acorn squash fruit into your meals, but they're not going to form the foundation of your meals. You're still going to want to incorporate those really nutrient-dense things like leafy greens and broccoli and cauliflower and asparagus and all of that good, micronutrition.
Mm-hmm. And a hedge for me anyway, and certainly for some of the people that I work with in my practice, is when you include a fair amount of fat, and your approach is liberal in terms of the right fats, but your version of the right fats is a little different than the American Heart Association version of the right fats. So we use on the Whole30 diet, I collect bacon grease. I use duck fat. I use ghee. Because butter's not permitted because you don't want the dairy protein. You want to really be dairy-free, but you can use dairy oil. And I'm also using a lot of coconut oil. So the fat really induces satiety and helps you with that, the term that you use often, it's a reset. You do sort of a reset on your appetite cues and on your metabolism so that you're no longer dreaming of, sugary desserts.
Yes, it definitely helps with cravings. It definitely helps with satiety. It also really helps to take people out of that sugar burner phase where you are completely reliant on sugar for energy. That kind of people who have to eat every 2 hours, yep. you get cranky and hungry if you don't. What we want to do is teach your cells how to use fat as fuel, both dietary fat and the fat that you've got stored in your body. And the way to do that is stop giving yourself sugar all the time and start eating more natural, healthy fats.
It's really interesting what you point out there. I've noticed a change in my own orientation to hunger. I'm pretty disciplined and I don't generally snack between meals, but I noticed that I can go longer after a big, hearty Whole30 meal. I can go for hours and hours and hours. And I feel fine. And then I hit the wall and I just really need to eat, but I don't I'm not looking between meals for, sugar, candy, snacky kind of foods, because there's something about the satiety that you get from a Whole30 meal that really does do a reset. And that's kind of a nice feeling. You're sort of free from these extrinsic the strings that pull you, you know, towards aberrant eating.
Exactly. And that's a really common experience with people on the Whole30, is they find their energy is very consistent and very steady throughout the day. They no longer have that 2 p.m. slump. Their body is no longer sending them signals that they're hungry in the form of blood sugar drops or blood sugar dysregulation. You know, when they just ate a meal a few hours ago, all of those things lead to feeling more satisfied between meals, not needing to snack as much, not needing as many cravings. And if you are going many hours between meals because a meeting runs later, you get stuck in traffic, you're able to cope and stay focused and stay calm and not be super hangry, which is a really nice benefit.
Right. I think the, like in the commercials, hangry.
Yeah.
Are you hangry?
Exactly.
Right. And of course, the answer to that is get a Snickers bar. But right. On the Whole30, that's not a possibility. So
that is not what I would say.
No. So another controversial elimination on the Whole30 diet is the elimination of legumes. And for me, you know, okay, I made a lot of bean soups. You know, I had bean dishes. It wasn't such a big deal. What really got me where I lived was the elimination of one of my favorite foods, a real trigger food for me, because I could go in with a tablespoon and just spoon it out. Peanut butter. Peanuts, mm-hmm. they're not a nut, they're a legume. So I had to say farewell to my peanut butter. I have about a half a dozen jars of peanut butter in my house. You know anybody who might want to use them? Because I don't know what to do with them anymore.
People and their peanut butter. I knew you were going to say it before you even did. You know, legumes, again, the scientific literature and our clinical experience shows that in general, legumes may be problematic for some people. Usually it's the fermentable carbohydrate portion of things like beans that are creating digestive distress and perhaps upsetting gut bacteria. Peanuts specifically, though, have a lot of really solid literature behind the idea that there's a particular protein in peanuts that has been known to cross the gut barrier, get into the bloodstream where it doesn't belong, and provoke the immune system. So there's specifically for that particular legume, there's a lot of reason to pull that out, reintroduce it, and see how it does. Luckily on the Whole30, you've got a great alternative in the form of almond butter or sunflower seed butter.
Sunnut butter is very nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very nice, but people do tend to overconsume them. They're about as salty, sweet, and fatty as you can get while still staying within the construct of the Whole30 rules. So we do encourage people to consume with caution.
Yeah, because that could be, you know, a little bit of an escape hatch. And I think, you know, one of the issues with the Whole30 is you have to be prepared. You have to have your logistics in order, because otherwise, if you're not, you're just going to dip your spoon in all these delectable nut butters and you'll be technically compliant, but you won't really be sticking to the spirit of the diet, eating the wide variety of foods that are suggested.
Exactly. You could do the Whole30 and be 100% compliant, eating nothing but dried fruit, bacon, and sun butter. But that's not really the kind of healthy diet and the healthy habit changes that we're trying to promote.
Exactly. Okay. So, you know, moving right along, a dairy, a no-no. And, you know, I understand that because one of the things that I often do with patients who have various ailments, digestive ailments, or, you know, anything ranging from nasal congestion to asthma to chronic migraines is a prostatitis is, you know, do a dairy elimination, see what happens. So, you know, you're pretty strict about that, not even butter allowed. So I get that. Then there's some interesting prohibitions on, you know, something that I used to think was like healthy, which was canola mayonnaise. You know, you go to the health food store and you think, well, hey, you know, this isn't the regular mayonnaise, the supermarket kind. This isn't Hellman's. This is made with canola oil, and that's supposed to be better. But on the Whole30 diet, that is not considered optimal, correct?
It's not, you know, we don't explicitly rule out certain vegetable oils, things like canola or safflower or sunflower. But what happens is you'll go to the grocery store and you'll see olive oil mayo and you'll think, great, yeah, mayonnaise made with olive oil. I know. And then you turn the label around and there's mostly soybean oil in it. There's a little bit of mayonnaise. There are all these stabilizers. There's always added sugar. So labels can be very deceiving. What we want to teach people to do with the rules of the Whole 30 and the fact that the rules are so black and white is read your labels and learn to examine what's in the food that you're eating and learn to figure out all the tricky ways that they add less healthy ingredients under different names to different labels. That's something that a lot of Whole 30ers say has stayed with them long after their program is over, is it's now become second nature to pick a product up and read what's in it before they put it in their mouths.
Okay, so one little controversial here is that one elimination that I see is not on the Whole 30, but it's something we sometimes use for patients who have, say, arthritis, is the nightshades. Nightshades are included, and a little surprising because some paleo diets. I mean, look, there are various iterations of the paleo diet. There's no question. There's nobody trademarked it. There's no gospel that's like the final arbiter of what's paleo. But some paleo diets exclude tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, green peppers. I think you comment on that and you say, well, if you think you have a problem with that, you know, maybe you should stay away. But it's not verboten on the general Whole 30 plan, correct?
You're right. You have a really good understanding of paleo, actually, and especially this particular protocol, which is known as the autoimmune protocol. We're not trying to turn the Whole 30 into a medical elimination diet. It is not designed to diagnose or treat specific medical conditions. For the vast majority of people on the Whole 30, these foods like potatoes, tomatoes, eggplant, peppers have very health-promoting properties. If you have a particular autoimmune condition, if you have joint conditions, particularly things like arthritis, bursitis, tendonitis, you may find that you are sensitive to these compounds in nightshade plants. But as a rule for the general Whole 30, we don't find that they're commonly problematic enough to pull them out as part of the basic foundation.
Okay, great. So I think we've established the basic ground rules for the Whole 30. Our listeners know that we divide these podcasts into two parts. So please join us for part two, because I want to comment on, you know, what are some of the effects of the Whole 30? What are people saying? What can you expect? And what about troubleshooting it? Are there pitfalls associated with this diet? Because our guest knows all about it. She is the co-originator of the Whole 30. She's Melissa Hartwig, author of a great book. It starts with food. I really urge you to read it. And there's also the Whole 30 book, which is both books contain specific instructions and recipes on how to implement this. Plus, there's a website, whole30.com. And Melissa, you know, before we depart from part one, I just want to commend you because you've made the Whole 30 really an exercise in access and very democratic and sort of an uncommercial enterprise, because on the one hand, you could say, well, you know, join this program, you know, for, you know, $49.95 per year, and we'll turn you on to, you know, everything about this. But it's hidden behind a paywall. Yes, we'd love people to buy your book. Yes, we'd love people to follow and, you know, participate with you. But it's out there. It's a resource. You've made it available to a giant community of people who want to explore this avenue towards wellness. And you're really to be commended.
Thank you so much. Yeah, the whole program is completely available for free, along with a ton of resources that we've created. We just want people to do the program and succeed with it. And you can certainly do that without, you know, having to buy the book if you choose not to.
Yeah, but buy the book. Nevertheless, buy the book. We urge you. Okay, so we'll go to part two and we'll talk more about the Whole 30 with today's guest, Melissa Hartwig. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.